This is Your Working Life, a podcast that provides you with tools, inspiration, and resources so you can enjoy your career and love your life. I'm Caroline Dowd Higgins. I'm a speaker, an author, and an executive coach. And today, I'm delighted to welcome back Amy Gallo to the show. Amy is a workplace relationship expert who helps leaders deal with conflict more effectively and navigate complicated workplace dynamics. Amy, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Caroline. It's nice to be here again.
Oh my goodness, I just love having you on the show. And today is a rather special opportunity to talk about a really cool book that you are very much a part of. You wrote an article that has become one of the chapters, and you also wrote a brilliant introduction. But I want to honor all of your fellow Harvard Business Review authors because it is this gorgeous compilation, but it's unique. So I need to give the setup. It is a play on the unforgettable lessons of the TV series Succession. And I know that that may resonate with a lot of people who are shaking their heads saying, oh, can't wait to see where this goes. But for those who may not know the TV series, Amy, would you set it up and help people understand that to give us context for our conversation today?
Yes, absolutely. And we actually think of this book as sort of the ultimate watch party for management nerds who are interested in the show and love the show as much as we did. So the show is an HBO series that had, I think it was 3 seasons total. It might have been 4. I have to refresh my memory on that. But it was a show about a fictional family that ran a media empire in New York City. And it was really a global media empire. And the family was led by this patriarch, Logan Roy, and he had 3 children who were possible heirs to this business. And the entire, you know, series is really about the family dynamics in terms of the kids who are vying to take over the family business, but also so much about how to run a business and how not to run a business, because this family and many of the people surrounding them and supporting them are quite toxic. They're rude to one another. They make terrible decisions. They're money hungry. They're completely disconnected from the reality of how most people live. It made for incredibly great watching. But to imagine being any of the characters in this series, it seems like a painful, painful experience.
Absolutely. And I have to reference the opening sentence of your beautiful introduction. When I sit down to watch Succession, I know I'm signing up for a nonstop cringe festival. And I say that with a smile on my face because I think that's how we felt watching the show. We were sort of diving into the icky, thinking, oh, I would never do that. But boy, am I enjoying watching it.
That's right. And I'll tell you, I have friends, including actually my partner, who cannot watch the show, just feel like it's too mean, it's too ugly, it's too toxic. But I sort of love that thing, partly because of the work I do around difficult conversations, conflict at work. I mean, this was just a minefield of things not to do when you're trying to navigate those issues at work.
Exactly. It was great, great research. And there's another phrase, whatever the Roys do, which is the family you just described, do the exact opposite. So it really teaches us a lot about what not to do as well.
That's right. We have an unofficial goal at HBR to rid the world of bad management. And this show was just such gold in terms of, you know, an example, an illustration of how bad, just how bad, and sometimes truly evil leaders and managers can be. And so, you know, when there were many of us at HBR editors who just loved the show. We had a Slack channel where we would, you know, exchange commentary about the most recent episode, share memes, laugh about some of the more absurd things that happened. So when we heard the show was ending, we thought, okay, it's time. It's time HBR does a book on this.
Oh, I love it. I absolutely love it. Well, we are the beneficiaries of your knowledge and your extraordinary HBR colleagues. So let's start. And of course, you are the author of the iconic Getting Along and the HBR Guide to Dealing with Conflict. So this is juicy stuff for you. But I'd like to open up by talking about the concept of giving
pep talks that inspire. And the show Succession, you couldn't bleep enough if people were trying to edit out bad language. You know, it was beyond expletives. And it got to a point where I was almost overstimulated by it. There was just so much of it. But say a little bit more, because we do often look to the leaders to be inspiring and motivational and rally the troops, especially in times of change, even in times of ambiguity.
Yeah. I mean, that's right. I think most people think of leaders as inspirational, as people to look up to, people who can motivate them. And, you know, the Roys really did the opposite, particularly Logan, the patriarch. I mean, in many ways, he just ran the business as cutthroat in a way as possible. He didn't really seem to care whether people felt inspired or motivated. He seemed to be extremely driven by money and expected others to be the same way. And more often than not, his pep talks were really about fear and threats and this very old school style of people will do what we want them to do if they fear for their jobs. And so that was a constant light motif in the show of, you know, in terms of bad management, of just relying on this really strict hierarchical command and control style, which so much research has shown is just not effective. You know, there's an article in the book from my colleague Dan McGinn, who wrote a book about pep talks actually and motivation. And so there's this really epic pep talk that Logan gives in season 4, episode 2, where he sort of refers to everyone as, you know, well, we can bleep the word out. He says, "You are beeping pirates," right? And he just talks about how they have to take over the competition. And it's one of those most astounding, jaw-dropping moments in the show where you're like, is he really saying this to a room full of employees? But, you know, Dan's article goes on to say what actually should be in a pep talk. And he, you know, has like some really good advice about what that should look like, including, you know, empathetic language, obviously missing from Logan's pep talk, meaning-making language, helping people understand why a task is important, and then also uncertainty-reducing language. So trying to eliminate a lot of fear that people have around change. And so, you know, I think that when you're thinking about how to motivate people, again, do the exact opposite of what Logan Roy does, but follow the advice in this great article that's part of the collection.
So I want to pull a thread, and, you know, it's funny. Obviously, you and I are both podcast hosts, and you're right. We edit out the bad language. There was no editing in Succession. I mean, it was full on, you know, verbal gymnastics. But let's talk about that Rogan Loy character, because admittedly, there are still people like that, maybe not to that degree or none that I'm aware of, but that command and control, especially for some of our older leaders who are part of that generational time, that do lead with fear or a strong arm. In your experience, is that working anywhere, or have they been expected to change?
So I think there is a big movement that toward getting people to change. And partly this has been led by research. I think of the research, for example, of Jane Dutton, who's a professor at University of Michigan, who's really shown that people express commitment and loyalty for a leader or for a company when they're shown compassion, right? Which is not, this command and control is not compassionate. It's not empathetic. And I think we can actually encourage leaders to be demanding, to have high expectations, to expect, you know, people to do good work and work hard while still being compassionate. And I think the mistake we made in the past and the mistake many of the leaders you're referring to still make is that we think if under stress, people will excel, right? That they'll show up, work hard, that level of stress will actually help them. And to some degree, that assumption is correct, that we do know people with a certain amount of stress do perform better. But once you reach the sort of limit of that stress level, it becomes counterproductive. And so, yes, here's how I would say it. most workplaces are stressful enough without a leader adding unnecessary competition, degrading people. It's another thing Logan Roy does quite a bit, right? And you know, and that sort of real strict, I'm gonna put fear in you to do your job, I really is counterproductive. And I do think there's some call to have people change. Now, has everyone gotten the memo? Absolutely not. I don't think there are, you know, hundreds of Logan Roys out there, but I wouldn't doubt if there are people who do subscribe to his way of leadership still, partly because it's what worked for them and they think it's going to work for others.
I agree with you. I don't think it's the majority, but they're still out there. You know, as an executive coach, it is not unusual for me to hear about that tyrannical kind of boss. And Amy, yeah. your article that is a chapter in the book, chapter 8, is titled, "I Didn't Keep Track of the Exact Number of Expletives He Used." And it's really about how to respond to a rude comment at work. So walk us through that, because I think we've all been there, right? Whether it was someone that, you know, weaponized that language or it was just off the cuff, regardless, it's cutting and debilitating.
Yeah. And there, the research on incivility at work, that's sort of the academic term, is very clear, which is that it hurts our productivity, it causes stress, it reduces creativity. There's just so many bad outcomes for the individual who is experiencing the incivility, maybe is on the receiving end of that rude comment, but also for people who witness it. And that's one of the things I have to say is so cringy about Succession is not only the interactions that are incredibly toxic, but then the number of people in the room who are observing it. And you have to think through, you know, you have to think about what are they internalizing? What kind of culture is this creating? So, you know, my article about responding to a rude comment was actually originally part of a collection we did about rudeness on the front line in, you know, sort of year two and three of the pandemic. We were hearing a lot of reports about people being sort of rudeness at work increasing, and particularly people who are on the front line, customer-facing jobs, being sort of the punching bag for unhappy and really stressed out customers. So this article was part of a package that tried to address that phenomenon. You know, in it, I give a couple pieces of advice. Like, number one, accept your emotional response, because as you said, it can be quite cutting. It can sting quite a bit. It can hurt. Try not to dismiss those feelings. I think the more you suppress them, the worse off you are. So accept that what happened was upsetting, was damaging, was, you know, maybe re-traumatizing in some ways. And then in some cases, you also have to think about that person may not have intended to be rude, right? They may actually just be frustrated or stressed out or misunderstood what the context of the conversation, what you were trying to achieve. I don't think that's true for Logan, but I do think in many cases, it's helpful to give the person the benefit of the doubt that perhaps they didn't actually mean to be rude. Maybe they're from a culture where what they're saying in terms of being direct and honest is not considered rude. And then you have to consider the risks of, okay, should I respond directly? Should I stand up for myself? Should I say something or should I not? And I think we often think about the risks of speaking up that will damage the relationship, will lose the client, will look like we're upset, which for some people is really a negative thing at work. I don't think that's necessarily the case, but for some people that's really hard. So we think about those risks, but we also need to think about the risks of not speaking up. What happens if you don't say something? And then once you've sort of done that careful cost-benefit analysis, if you have decided to speak up, and that's a real personal decision I think each person has to make depending on the situation, you know, you then have to decide what's the right time. Do you say something right away? How do you make sure that you're not accusing that person of something that maybe they did not intend? So really trying to focus on I statements, right? I was hurt by what you said, or it's rude to tell someone that they're going to lose their job, or it's rude to tell someone that you know their input is useless, whatever it might be. And then I also encourage people to ask questions, you know, be curious about why they said what they did. What did they actually intend? Just try to sort of engage the person a little bit to understand what's happening. And then, you know, one of the biggest things is there's really interesting research that shows when we're in a situation that requires us to speak up, hypothetically speaking, when we're not in that situation, we say, oh, yes, I would definitely speak up. I would definitely say something. But in the moment, so few of us actually do. So it can be really helpful to have just a few responses ready, right? Something, just a few lines that you feel comfortable saying, you've practiced ahead of time. So when you are in that moment of rudeness, you are prepared to respond.
I love that. Have them in your back pocket, ready to go. Amy, we'll be right back after a quick break. I'd like to tell you about a special offer. If you want to bring your podcast to life or up your podcast game, you can get up to 2 months of free podcasting service with Libsyn using my special code CDHWORK. The Libsyn team will get your podcast on Apple and Spotify and give you access to critical stats and all the support you need to sound your best and grow your show. Use my special code CDHWORK. Hiring the right speaker for your event is a tremendous responsibility. You need a speaker who will work within your budget and engage your audience. Whether you're looking to retain or grow top talent, create a healthy workplace culture, or prevent burnout in your organization, I can create customized content to help you recharge, reignite, or reinvent your career. Let's talk about how I can help you achieve your special event goals. Connect with me at caroline.higgins.com. Amy, one of the articles that became chapter 3 in the book is written by your HBR colleagues, Frances Fry and Anne Morris, both of whom have been on this show. So I want to honor them and take a look at their chapter, which is titled, I Can Trust You, Right? No. And it's all about beginning with trust. And again, such an important theme in succession. But I'd love to hear your take about that, because I think we're in agreement that trust is I think, essential and really powerful when it's happening in a work environment. But sadly, it's not always there.
Yes. And I'm so glad. I'm such a fan of Frances and Anne's work. And I'm so glad you picked this article to talk about, because it's one that I reference probably monthly, if not weekly, because it's got such great advice about how leaders can build trust, especially when trust has been broken. And they identify three core drivers of trust, and they call those authenticity, right? So being authentic, being yourself, people trust that you are someone who is true to themselves. Then also the logic. So they, have faith in your judgment and competence. They believe you to be a logical, rational person. And then empathy, that you actually care about them. And that, they call it a trust triangle. And I think that triangle is so valuable. And what I love about the advice that Frances and Anne give in this article is that they think of it as these three as levers, and really trying to figure out, they call it your wobble, right? Which of those three, is it authenticity, is it logic or empathy, do you struggle with most as a leader? And really, how can you improve on that? So if you're someone who unfortunately doesn't come off as the real you, maybe you've gotten feedback that people feel like you say things you don't really mean, or your sort of tone of voice sounds fake, how can you work on that so that you can increase this sort of angle of the triangle of trust, so that people can more reliably trust you? I'm interested to hear, Caroline, actually, because I know you love this article too. What for you stands out in this piece?
Yeah, I love the wobble. You know, I've talked to both of them about that too, and I think that is such a good technique for us to really think about. And I also love that we need to be empowered in the trust relationship. Trust is earned. It's not gratuitous. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen automatically. And it's not a one and done. It's a continuous experience that can be heightened and that can also go in the opposite direction, right? You can lose trust for a variety of reasons. So I think my biggest takeaway there is it's a two-way street and it's a continuous journey.
Yes, that's right. And I think, you know, there's that common phrase, I don't remember exactly what it, but like trust is really hard to build, but really easy to break. And I think that's where that triangle comes in so helpful, because you can, when you violate someone's trust or when you fear that people feel like you've, you know, people see you as untrustworthy because of a missed deadline or something you absolutely said was going to happen did not happen, or you made a big mistake, right? You can look at that triangle and say, okay, where do I need to improve? You know, where do I, what would be most effective in trying to restore this relationship? Is it trying to lean into the empathy, into the authenticity, or into the logic?
So, Amy, as we wrap, let me ask, you know, you are an expert who is in the field working through helping leaders and organizations navigate these very intense and complicated workplace dynamics. Are you hopeful? Do you see positive change happening? Tell me a little bit about what you're seeing.
Oh, such a good question. And it honestly, if you ask me in a week, I might have a different answer. If you asked me yesterday, I might have a different answer. But overall, I think I do feel optimistic. You know, what we were talking about earlier in terms of that command and control style, I do think, if I think about succession in particular, the way people were horrified by how this family operated, how they led, how the managers led, I do think that's a good sign that there's been a big shift in the workplace, that we need to care about people's feelings and we need to have an emotional an emotional caring in the workplace. And that, I think, is really a positive trend. And we're seeing more and more research come out about the importance of trust, the importance of humility, the importance of compassion, all of which are just wonderful, wonderful movements, I think, to be happening in our workplaces. I do, you know, have some concerns about the way we handle conflict and controversial topics and disagreements in work. And that's, as you know, my mission is to help individuals and organizations and leaders especially figure out how do we handle those things in a way where people can speak up when they have a concern, when people can voice a difference of opinion without being shut down, you know, where we have that psychological safety in organizations where that's really necessary for people to shine and do their best work. So I'm both hopeful and also cautious.
Well, Amy Gallo, the world of work is better because of you. And I'm truly grateful for your time and expertise today. And I want to share the title of this brilliant book. It's called You Can't Make a Tomalet Without Breaking Some Greggs, Toxic Management Lessons from Succession and What to Do Instead. And as I mentioned, it pairs advice from HBR experts, including you, and researchers with some of the most unforgettable, hilarious, and cringy moments from the show Succession. And of course, it's available on Amazon and all major book retailers. Amy, deep thanks to you and all of your colleagues for this incredible book. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Caroline. This was really fun.
Your Working Life is now available on all major podcast platforms, and leave us a review so we can learn how we're doing. And it'll also help new listeners find us online. And a special shout out to my extraordinary podcast colleagues, Laura Deck, Executive Director of Publicity and Communications, and Claire McInerney, Executive Producer. Thank you for making this show awesome for our global audience. We now have listeners in 34 countries. I'm Caroline Dowd-Higgins. Thanks for listening.